From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a woman named Christine Crawford was doing her psychiatric rotation in medical school. As a black woman, she knew the disparities in American healthcare. Black people were twice as likely to be uninsured as white people. Black people were less likely to seek needed care, especially in mental health. And that last point is what convinced Christine that she needed to go into psychiatry in the first place. And yet when she shared her decision with friends and family, the response was routinely negative. As she recently recalled, her loved ones would ask her, "Why don't you want to become a real doctor?" A friend asked if she really wanted to work with those people. And Christine wondered, who are those people? It occurred to her that people who need mental health services are still stigmatized, and she feels that is especially true in predominantly black communities where she grew up. She said in a recent interview with Massachusetts General Hospital, quote, "Ironically, as my career as a psychiatrist progressed, I came to learn that many who responded most negatively to my career choice were the very people I was dedicating my life to helping, African Americans who silently live with mental illness for fear of being judged," end quote. And she has wanted to change that. That has also been a priority of focus for New York State Senator Samra Brouck. And this hour, we've got a chance to sit down with the senator. We're going to talk about mental health and in different communities. We're going to talk about student mental health, youth mental health. There's a local youth mental health advisory board we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about maternal mental health and a lot of the work that the senator has been doing. She serves this 55th Senate District, if my math is still correct, Senator Samra Brouck. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you back here. That story from Christine Crawford that I was reading from Massachusetts General Hospital was, to me, was pretty striking because, you know, I don't want to paint too broadly here, but her experience, you know, with friends saying, well, I mean, is that a real doctor? Is a psychiatrist a real doctor? There are still big barriers and stigmas out there, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. And as you were telling that story, I was just recounting the number of ways that that kind of stigma and, you know, thought process still shows up in the work now. And first of all, you know, psychiatrists are MDs.
Yeah.
So, you know, just for that. But also what struck me about that, you know, story is, you know, what is she said, like those people, right? We are all those people. We are all those people, you know? And one of the things that I've seen a lot in this work is oftentimes I think, you know, when you think about headlines and what people think of as mental health, it's severe mental illness, which is certainly something that people suffer from. But there are a lot of challenges that most people we know, including ourselves, probably go through. And that's really where you think of that continuum of care. You want someone, you need a workforce, right, to support individuals through those semi-hard moments so they don't get to that crisis moment too.
Well, and so I often refer to myself as the world's most advantaged person. I try not to do that to like virtue signal. I just try to recognize that I have a lot of advantages in life, and I try to be cognizant of those things. And yet I had a moment a few weeks back where I just felt absolutely torched. And what I came to realize through conversations at work was my fear of what would happen if I just, you know, verbalize a little bit like, hey, I might need a day or I might need a couple. I was more fearful of, you know, something that didn't exist. The management here has been phenomenal. And yeah, I can't be more appreciative of that. That's another advantage I have, to have management who is receptive to that. But I had created like this dragon in my mind of like, well, you can't ask for time off. You can't take time off. It's hard to take time off. Who's going to cover? What are you going to do? And if I've got all these advantages and I'm worried about talking about it, right? So, and I'm not necessarily even feeling any stigma. So what are the steps that, in your view, have to be taken, broadly speaking? And then we're going to talk legislatively about what's out there, and we're going to kind of get granular in different categories of mental health. But how do we start kind of pulling down the stigma?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, first of all, and of course, I came into this position where, you know, it was January 2021. So, you know, that was peak. You know, we still didn't have everyone have vaccines. We weren't fully open. I mean, it was a very specific time to come into this position and to not only come in as a senator, but to come in as the chair of mental health. And so immediately, every story I heard, right, every call we were getting was around the mental health challenges. And I share that because I think that especially during the COVID pandemic, in some ways, even though we were all isolated, in some ways the emotional walls came down a little bit. And I was sharing this with someone the other day that even on the, you know, when I was campaigning in 2020 before being in the office, via Zoom calls and phone calls and texts, there was something about my interactions with individuals around this community that were almost more raw. And people were actually sharing things that they maybe would have never shared with a politician coming to their door, especially on a Zoom. Think about it. I'm in your living room now on a Zoom versus knocking a door where maybe I see, you know, your front hallway. And I think something kind of shifted where people have been a little bit more open about what they've been going through. I also think that we can't hide a lot of the challenges that exist in our mental health sector. You know, even our Surgeon General, it's now been 2 years since he called, you know, the youth mental health crisis the crisis of our time. That was the first time, I think, at that level we had heard those words about something like youth mental health. And so, you know, I do think on the 30,000 foot view, that there were a number of things that converged over the last few years that have either made it okay or destigmatized the idea of talking about mental health. And I also think that, you know, we as leaders and, you know, me as a legislative elected leader, you as a leader, you know, in public radio, you know, we also have, especially the adults in the room, I always say, right, we also have the opportunity and really, I think, the responsibility of actively destigmatizing it, right? And saying out loud, I'm taking this day. Nope, you know, it's not because my leg is broken. It's not because I'm, you know, physically ill, but I need this day for my mental health and my own mental wellness. And so that's also part of what I've tried to do with the understanding as we sit here in Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, as a Black woman, as the chair of mental health, you know, as a representative of our community, I have a platform. And you know, folks know if I show up somewhere, I'm probably going to talk about mental health. And my hope is that eventually there's less and less discomfort.
Before we get to some of the specific works, one more question sort of from kind of the 30,000 foot view. To the extent that there is opposition to more government intervention in this area or government funding or use of taxpayer dollars, it typically sounds something like this. I think there is concern that that we could go past a tipping point. In other words, if we did a poor job for decades of talking about mental health, recognizing it as real health, honoring what people need, et cetera, that if you can go too far the other way, you convince everyone that they have some sort of an affliction that should be debilitating, or that government can fund every program that can fix everything. Again, that I think is I don't know how common that view is, but I mean, I do hear it. I get it in the emails every time we talk mental health. And so from your perspective, are you concerned that we could go past the tipping point? Are you concerned that we can tell everybody, hey, be so much aware of your mental health that what used to be a bad day is now a crisis, et cetera? And how much can we fund and sort of legislate our way out of some of that?
Yeah. And I think that's a fair question. You know, in my few years in the Senate, you know, I think we've done a lot of things differently than had been done for decades. And so we face this a lot because we are trying to transform certain systems, trying to reverse trends that had been in place for, you know, decades before coming into this position. I think, first of all, and I say this as someone who works in the state government, I do not think state government is going to solve everything, to be clear. Right. And to be honest, even the programs we're discussing will not be fully funded through the government. Many of these programs are actually coming from communities, and they are seeking funding to have longevity and sustainability to be able to grow the number of people they serve. And I absolutely want to be that resource. But I think the other key piece is it's also about mental health education. And so, you know, one of the grants we were able to bring here locally was actually to a school program that was educating young kids on, you know, when you start feeling that hot moment or when you start feeling kind of fidgety or when you're feeling these things in your body or thoughts going through your head, this is what's happening to your hippocampus. And I literally had a second grader explaining to me, like, my hippocampus is doing this right now, and that's why I'm feeling this. And that's not a crisis moment, but he's understanding. And so I think because there's been so much stigma around mental health, I always try to make analogies to physical health because I think we're more comfortable and more understanding of that. So for example, you know, we talked about urgent care, right? And if you dislocate, my daughter dislocated her elbow a few weeks ago. So we went to urgent care. There was no shame, no stigma. I went in, I said, this is what happened. They reset it and we moved on, you know, no big deal. Similarly, you know, we've been creating urgent care models for mental health. And so mm-hmm. I use that example of, would you sit at home with a screaming child who's in pain? Or you shouldn't sit at home with a child who's also in, you know, emotional pain. But I use that example because when you think about, you know, are we going to make people think that everything, every emotion they have is a crisis? This is about education. And so in a physical aspect, would we want someone walking around with a bum knee, right? And just hobbling everywhere without the understanding that they could go get help, right? And get a cast or get it reset.
Would we tell them to suck it up?
Right. Well, you probably wouldn't, because that would lead to, you know, this has all happened to all of us, where you overcompensate on your right side, then your left side gets more messed up and you're right. And so you're just compounding issues. And so I think of it similarly, right? So maybe that's not a crisis. You can go get a set of crutches, you know, set it, whatever you do. I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, but, you know, and there's no shame in that, right? And you're not worried that person is going to ask for surgery just because their knee hurts. So similarly, we want to educate people and give it different intervention points so that fewer people get to a crisis, but at least, especially young people, have the language to describe what they're going through and to seek the help they need.
Well, can we start with the Student Lifeline Act then? Is that something we can talk about here?
I would love to talk about that.
Tell listeners what it is, and then let's talk about what could happen here next.
Absolutely. So the Student Lifeline Act, again, is one of those kind of ground up ideas that we came up with out of the success that has occurred in New York State with the 988 Crisis Lifeline. And so, as many folks know, you know, this last week, we celebrated the second year anniversary of the national 988 line. And what you should realize is that here in New York State, we've actually been doing a really great job of delivering that service, right? So by and large, most calls are resolved right there with a crisis counselor under 2% of the time. Do we actually have to send, you know, a first responder? And so one of the things that we've been looking at is how to create more access to this lifeline, because what we've seen is that in that moment of crisis, most people, if they're able to reach a trusted, trained counselor, they can actually de-escalate it right there via phone or via text. And so with a lot of the work we've done with youth, with our Youth Mental Health Advisory Board, it was about how do we create that access. And so what the Student Lifeline would do is actually put that number on the back of college ID cards. And so if anyone remembers, when you're in college, that card is used to get into your dorms. It's used to pay your
snacks.
And
it still is, right? Because it's longer and longer since I've been in college.
Yeah.
I think they're still
Same.
Using it. Yeah, yeah.
They're still, and you know what? We had a press conference last week, and I had some college students, and he actually brought his ID card and said, look how worn out this is. You can barely see my photo because I use it multiple times a day. And to know that it's going to sit there staring at me every time I pull out my card. And the idea is you're raising that awareness so that when you may find yourself in a crisis moment, you feel maybe a little more comfortable calling or texting. And so that's what the Student Lifeline Act will do. Very proud. I carry this with Assemblymember Sarah Clark. It has passed both houses for the first time. And now we are working with the governor to ensure that she will sign it.
That's a strange last sentence. Working. Why hasn't she signed it?
Well,
when could she sign it?
Tomorrow. Today. She could sign it
okay.
today.
So why
governor
hasn't
Hochul?
She signed it?
You know, I can't explain why she hasn't signed it yet. You know, I know she's got hundreds of bills on her desk.
But she hasn't told you that has no intention of signing it, or she's opposed to it?
No. We believe that she, okay. You know, I will say, being the chair of mental health under this governor is a very special place that I don't take for granted, because this is a governor who has talked about the importance of mental health. She has said mental health more than I ever heard, you know, from her predecessors. She made a $1 billion investment. I do believe she's very, very invested in youth mental health. She herself is hosting youth mental health roundtables around the state. So, you know, we believe this is very in line with her goals. We believe we have, you know, the executive's support on this. And so we are hoping that we're looking at, you know, a bill signing by the end of this year.
By the end of the year. Okay. And our colleague Noelle Evans reported on this issue and talked to Jennifer Lake. I'm sure you know, executive director of Goodwill, the Finger Lakes. And that's one of the houses for the local call centers. So Jennifer was telling WXXI, she said, this legislation has the education component that will let college students know you don't have to be having suicidal ideation or suicidal thoughts to call 988. You can call 988 when you're having a bad day, when you're very anxious, when you're feeling overwhelmed, long before you get to that point. Exactly what you have been saying here. What it made me wonder is the younger the adult in this country, the less likely they are to want to call anybody. Usually if I get a phone call from someone under the age of 50 now, I'm like, well, is something wrong? Why are they calling? At the same time, I think that that's a generation that might be a little bit more educated, you know, able to understand and how to talk about mental health. And so maybe they will call 988. Even if they're not calling mom and dad, maybe they'll call 988.
And that's exactly part of the beauty of the Student Lifeline Act. And I also want to point out, I'm a millennial, so you will rarely get a call from me either.
Okay.
Yeah. But I text. I text like it's literally my job. And so you can text the 988 line. And I have actually gone through it to see what that experience would be like so that I can better speak to it as well. And that, I think, is key. You know, some of the youth development work I did before I was in office, I learned very quickly, millennials, younger millennials, Gen Z, and now I guess my daughter's like Gen Alpha, which she's
alpha.
Not getting a phone. She's two, so she's not getting one for a very long time. But for those who do, it's messaging. They want that direct messaging. They don't want a call. And sometimes it's also a privacy thing, right? You're around
sure. Oh,
other
yeah.
people. And so you can also text, which I think is really important, and we're hoping that young people will take advantage of that as well.
So that's the story with the Student Lifeline Act, and maybe there will be news on that before the end of the year with the governor's signature. I'm going to take a couple of phone calls in a second. Let me just ask the senator, you know, separate question. You talked about, you know, your daughter's two?
Two.
So it's going to be a while before you got a kid on maybe social media. But how do you feel about legislating? Because there's a lot of talk about the way social media impacts health, particularly kids' health, teens' health, preteens' health, adolescents, young adults. Is there any legislative component that you think is required to deal with this, or do you think it's cultural? Do you think we have to learn how to be better consumers and better educated?
I think absolutely it's both. I think for any major change we've seen, you need a cultural shift. And oftentimes it requires legislation, right? And so, you know, here in New York, we have passed a couple of bills specifically on social media, essentially, you know, curbing it in specifically for young people. My colleague, Senator Gonardis, led a lot of the charge. And, you know, I'll share that for me, as someone who I actually worked in technology too, and so I understood the power of technology and that connection via social media, and we used it for good. We were mobilizing young people all over the country, all over the world to do great, you know, community service in their community. So it definitely can be used for good. We know that. But I have to say, the deeper I look into the research, and as a parent myself, you know, our own Surgeon General, again, you know, are coming out saying there are things we need to be considering about creating a safer space for our young people specifically, and their rapidly developing brains, right? And so we did do that in New York, but we know that, you know, legislation is not just a one and done. There needs to be a shift, and there needs to be responsible use, right, of these platforms. So, you know, on a personal note, I've got at least, I'm hoping, a decade before I have to deal with those things and figure out how we want to do it in our family. But certainly as someone who is representing so many parents and so many children, I do think that, you know, I agree, and I was a co-sponsor of that legislation, but I heavily deliberated and I really looked into it and decided finally that I did think that it was the right thing to do. And my hope is that it will help.
Let me grab a couple of phone calls for State Senator Summer Brook from District Number 55, who's with us in studio this hour. Frank in Greece first. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello, Doctor. Hello, Senator. I just wanted to say that I was fortunate enough about 20 years ago to receive one-on-one psychiatric care through Medicaid, Child Health Care Plus, and I don't think I'd be in the position I'm in today, the better position I'm in today, if I did not receive in-depth counseling and pharmacological intervention. It was a complex case. It's still a complex case, but I think Medicaid should cover psychiatric care.
Okay. Senator, yeah. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm glad. I mean, I love hearing stories of where people actually do get the care they need, right? And I think that sometimes we overlook the stories like that because, of course, I'm trying to fix the problem. So I'm glad that you shared that because it does show that expanding Medicaid coverage, and right, that is technically a government intervention. It's a government program. But that is the way that we can fill gaps for a lot of people who aren't able to get care. One of the things that we've been trying to do over the last few years is creating better parity for insurance and Medicaid rates, right? Because that is oftentimes why we are unable to retain a solid workforce when it comes to mental health and psychiatric care, because they literally cannot stay in business, right? They can't keep these facilities open. And so I'm glad you shared that. And that's certainly one of the things that we've been trying to work on is, you know, expanding Medicaid. Because the truth is, whatever your health insurance is, whether it's Medicaid or private insurance or Medicare, you should know that you're going to get whatever, you know, ailment you have or whatever need you have. You should know that it's going to be covered, right? This game that folks have to play to navigate systems to try to find the right kind of care when they're already potentially, you know, not feeling their best can be impossible. And so many people go without care. So I'm glad you shared that. And that's definitely something that we've been trying to do.
Frank, good luck to you. Thank you for that. Let me get David in Rochester next on the phone. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I want listeners to be aware, I cannot announce this yet, but I'm working with a local mental health agency to start 3 support groups for mental health people dealing with mental health issues in early September. I'm just working out the final details, and I'm very excited about this because I had run a support group back in between 2000 and 2006 for parents who had bipolar children. That was the first and only support group in the nation that was dedicated to pediatric bipolar. So I'm just very excited. I will be sending WXHI more details and be putting notices in the DNC city newspaper. And I'm also working with the New York State Office of Mental Health, advocate, Maria Cruz. And I will be in touch with Summer Brooks' office as well to find out about more funding and support avenues.
David, thank you very much. Senator?
Great. Well, I look forward to the email of being able to support. I would love to point something out of specifically as you're bringing up support groups, which I think is a topic I'd love to share with people as well. And that's the power of peers. And so, you know, I've talked about this a lot, whether it's through, you know, a Daniel's Law legislation that is heavily centered around peers, but that peer support, individuals who have lived experience, who have loved ones with lived experience, whether with mental illness, mental health challenges, substance use, substance misuse, they are an incredible asset and resource. And what we have seen is their ability, that peer support can sometimes cut through the noise that even a provider can't do and making that connection with an individual who needs help. And so I think, you know, that's why I'm happy to support things like, you know, growing support groups, because when you see the difference that can make for someone to really see you and understand you can be absolutely incredible and can sometimes be that first intervention moment to get you right to feel comfortable with a psychologist or a social worker or even a psychiatrist if you need that.
David, thank you. And by the way, I'm wondering if what you just talked about, Senator, is related. You mentioned the local youth mental health advisory board. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Absolutely. So one thing that has been very important to me in this work is that, you know, I have lots of ideas of what I think people need, but no one can tell me better than the individuals themselves. And, you know, especially looking at the youth mental health moment that we're in and the crisis that we're in, we wanted to make sure that we were being responsible in our legislative priorities. And so we started our inaugural Youth Mental Health Advisory Board. We are very excited and enthusiastic to see actually people all over the state apply to be a part of this group. And I'll just tell you quickly, you know, the stories that you heard from these young people about why this work was important to them were just absolutely just so compelling and, you know, heart-wrenching, but also heartwarming, right? Because they're going through a lot, but they're also willing to use that experience to help others. And so it was specifically for folks who lived in 55th Senate District. So so we started that this year, and this group has been meeting, you know, several times. I've met with them. They've met with my legislative director. They meet with my staff, and they've actually come up with proposals. So it's really a back and forth feedback on how we can better put together our own priorities. And some of these things come from from these conversations, things like the Student Lifeline Act, right, of being able to create more access. And so they've also talked a lot about the peer piece. They have talked about how sometimes they want to talk to someone their age, right, someone who can have a better understanding of what they're going through. And so that's, again, why I think the peer support and putting that in the middle of the conversation rather than, you know, do a piece of legislation and then say maybe we'll allow peers to do this as well, mm-hmm. really bringing them in, I think is going to be really important.
Listeners, if you want to add to the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. My guest this hour is State Senator Sahmer Brouck, who has been working, among many other issues, a lot on mental health in different capacities. And when we come back from our only break of the hour, we'll talk about maternal mental health. We're going to talk a bit more about the disparities across different backgrounds and racial lines, and they are stark, and what else could be done about that. And we'll work in more of your feedback and comments as well as we talk to Senator Sahmer Brouck on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about big plans in the city of Rochester for its first ever nature center. It's going to be happening in Maplewood Park, which is an Olmsted Park, by the way. When's the last time you visited an Olmsted Park? Frederick Law Olmsted wanted more of us to be connected to nature, and the city of Rochester thinks the new Nature Center can help us do that. We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. State Senator Sahmer Brouck is my guest. And, you know, when you were running for office, you were not yet a mother. You are a mother of a two-year-old. When I was first in journalism, I was not a dad. My son's now 12. I think that it is not impossible to be childless your whole life and care about the future. And I only bring this up because, Senator, I almost couldn't believe what I heard from J.D. Vance, who could be the next vice president of the United States. He was he's a senator from Ohio, of course, my home state. And he said in a Fox News interview that, quote, "We are effectively run in this country via the Democrats, who are a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made. And so they want to make the rest of the country miserable, too," end quote. He said that included Vice President Harris, U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And he went on to say, quote, "How does it make any sense that we've turned our country over to people who don't really have a direct stake in it?" End quote. Yeah. Look, my perspective as a human being has changed as a dad. I don't make any bones about that. Like, it has definitely affected me. But to claim that if I wasn't able to have children, that I wouldn't have a stake in the future, or that I would just automatically be a nihilistic person without any real care about decisions and who that could affect because I don't have kids, I don't get that. Oh, by the way, Pete Buttigieg is dad. Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, is a stepmother to a couple with her husband Doug, and those kids view her as mom or mamala. That's what the family. So, and those are just data points. But I also think does it matter if Representative Ocasio-Cortez has children or not? Does that mean that she can't care about the future? And is the Democratic Party just a bunch of childless cat ladies? I thought it was a bizarre set of comments, and I just wondered what you think before we talk maternal mental health.
Well, we only have 30 minutes left, so I have a lot of words about J.D. Vance. But here's actually, given everything that's happened in the last 72, 96 hours, I'm losing track at this point, but it is so ironic that not birthing a child has become something that someone like this wants to weaponize, when in most rooms, it's actually the opposite, right? You know, when I had my daughter, I learned I was the second sitting state senator in New York history to give birth while serving. That's wild to me.
Oh, I wouldn't have known that. Yeah,
So it's wild to me. And the things I had to do to change the way we do business and legislate to allow me to do both of those things and to do both of them well, right? And so what I really think this points to more is just that they will stop at nothing to weaponize whatever they can against us. Right. And it's like, for so long, it's hard to be a mom or a parent and do this work. Now you're being criticized for not having a child yet or ever and can't do this work. So it's nonsensical. And what it really comes down to is any identity that we hold for the next 105 days, is it, probably will be weaponized. And the people that were just talked about, including myself, before, you know, I had my child, were incredibly effective leaders doing things for the future. I think about our local schools. Before I ever thought about having a child in our local schools, I was one of the loudest advocates to fully fund foundation aid, right? That created the largest investment in public schools in our history. I wasn't even thinking about having a kid then, but I was invested in the future, right? Think about our climate goals, fighting for childcare. I didn't have to go through it to understand it, right? So not to discount the experience of being a parent. It's been one of the best experiences of my life, and most challenging.
Same for me, absolutely.
Yeah. But, you know, I think we always have to contextualize things that come out of Vance's mouth or anyone around him, right? But I think we have to contextualize it that there will always be something to criticize and weaponize. And let's just focus on facts and focus on records and look at what not only those national leaders, but here locally, we've been able to do regardless of parenting status.
Well, let's talk about maternal mental health. And I know this is important to you as an issue. What do you want listeners to understand about not only this issue, but maybe what's happening at the state level?
Yeah. You know, first and foremost, you know, the top of the conversation, we talked about stigma. We talked about education around mental health. I think it's important that we understand in general that maternal mental health conditions are the number one most common pregnancy-related complication. So we are talking about 1 in 5 birthing people who have to deal with a maternal mental health condition. That is not something I knew. That was not a statistic that was floating around until I started digging into this work. And when you look at even the causes of death, when you look at our own state DOH data, maternal mental health conditions contribute to many of the preventable deaths, and these are preventable. And so when you're looking at some of the challenges that we're facing, things like the fact that, you know, black birthing people are twice as likely to have a maternal mental health condition, but half as likely to get the help they need, right? When you start looking at the different parts of this challenge, there's actually a lot of fixes. There are a lot of things, low-hanging fruit, that we can do to help address this. One of those, what I believe was low-hanging fruit, was the depression screenings. So again, you know, yes, my own experience helped inform because I went through these screenings at my pediatrician appointments. But there are these depression screenings that, you know, depending on your provider, you may receive or you may not receive postpartum. And an interesting point is that many people don't see their provider as the birthing person for another 6 weeks. It was like, see you later. You know, the baby's born. I didn't even talk to my OB for 6 weeks, but I was at the pediatrician every other day with my daughter. And it was there that they gave these screenings. And so one of the things we found about these screenings is that they may be missing certain questions that are more culturally competent to a more diverse set of individuals to actually catch when they're maybe do have a maternal mental health condition, right? Questions about the social determinants of health and mental health, they're missing oftentimes from these screenings. So we passed a study for DOH to investigate what the impacts were of this postpartum screening. And here's the best part, because I think a lot of people don't get to see the fruits of the labor. And I know that was an interesting pun to use in this context, but a lot of folks don't get to see that through line with state government. Here's the through line for you, and here's an impact of that work. We did this study. Out of that study came recommendations. We have already rewritten a bill based on those recommendations and passed it in the Senate this year. And one of those recommendations was for DOH to put out requirements, suggestions around the protocols for giving these screenings. Because what they found is what I identified at the top. Not everyone was getting these screenings. And so now they're actually asked to do these screenings in the pediatrician's office. Because what I learned is that's not a statewide protocol right now. I just happen to have a very thorough, comprehensive provider. And so that's really an incredible thing. In a couple years, you went from passing a study, getting the results, and then actually implementing some of these recommendations.
Just looking at the data that kind of corresponds to how we opened this program and the data that may further underline the need to take different approaches with different people, different communities, et cetera, not have a one-size-fits-all, in other words. So just some of the data on mental health in this country. Black people have higher rates of PTSD compared to white people. 8.7% of Black Americans diagnosed with PTSD or assumed to have PTSD. It's about 7% of white people. 65% of African American youth report traumatic experiences compared to 30% of American peers from all other ethnic groups. Black people are far less likely to seek care. Statistics tell us about 25% of African Americans seek mental health treatment. 40% of white Americans do. Nearly 10% of Black Americans do not have health insurance. About 5.2% of white Americans do not have health insurance. And only 2% of U.S. psychologists are Black. So the disparities are in many, many different categories. And so when you talk about looking for the need to maybe do things differently, change the approach, et cetera, what is ultimately the kind of evidence that would tell you this intervention is working? Is it wiping out all of those disparities? I mean, like, how do you evaluate this and say, we acted, this is working?
That's a great question. You know, I think that, of course, the goal at the end of the day, I think, you know, the vision is that we don't have those disparities, right? I mean, that is the vision. The vision,
absolutely.
The vision is, you know, my vision, you know, when it comes to mental health and addressing some of those disparities is someone who recognizes they have a challenge, someone who recognizes they may need some extra help, knows exactly where to go, feels comfortable going there, and someone's there to open the door when they get there, who is welcoming, who understands them, and they're able to, you know, start a treatment plan and get the help that they need. That is the vision. I think the incremental steps to get there are things like, and especially when it comes to government interventions, right, are things like, let's study that, right? At a state level, let's actually use state resources to look and identify what is happening in our state. And so I do think that things like that study around the depression screenings, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the success markers is, okay, we have a recommendation. Okay, well, we're still waiting to get this one signed. But, you know, once that gets signed, what changes do we see? What behavior changes do we see in the providers? What changes do we see in the information that they're collecting and the amount of untreated, you know, mental health conditions when it comes to maternal mental health. That's the same reason why we, you know, another incremental change was the maternal mental health work group. So that was something that, you know, we've studied maternal mortality in New York State. We have a maternal mortality review board, but we have not dug into the maternal mental health and what's going on in New York State. And so we passed this work group, passed both houses, got vetoed in 2022, but last year in 2023, we got it into the budget, right? And not only did we get it in the budget, we actually allowed to get reimbursed for childcare for any of these voluntary work group members. So parents can actually join this work group and inform, again, that peer piece, right, of people with lived experience, inform some of the recommendations. So I think all of these things are markers that we are moving in the right direction, but we have to keep that North Star. We have to keep that vision of what we want for everyone, regardless of race, language, you know, culture, whatever it is.
We're going to come back to phone calls and emails in just a second. Let me just also hit one other point on maternal health. And I know that a subject that is passionate to you is the subject of doulas. And so this is one that I have a bias on because of my own experience. When my son was born 12 years ago, you know, we had a doula who was unbelievable. And I remember at the time being told, there was a phrase that I never forgot. And again, it's 12 years old, and I don't want to like propagandize here, but what I was told was if a doula were a drug, it would be illegal to withhold it, you know, during labor. It was an amazing thing to hear. And I went, okay, like let's not withhold the doula. our doula was wonderful. And I wonder now how that fits into some of your ideas on what people should have access to and if anything, what the state should be doing.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you had that experience.
Yeah, it was really good.
And 12 years ago, so early adapter here.
I mean, it wasn't like, I don't think we were the first, but. You know,
right. Yeah. But I do think, you know, more, you know, definitely 2 years ago, the first time I said doula, most people didn't know what I was talking about. Now, if I go in a room and I say, who knows what a doula is, especially if it's a room I'm in, most people actually have heard of it. And I actually love that phrase that you used, because we don't want to withhold it from people. And so, you know, part of our advocacy and some of our legislative pushes have led to January 1st of this year, Medicaid is covering doula services statewide. We're the 13th state to do that. I mean, when you talk about trailblazing, when you talk about, you know, really leading the pack on this, New York really truly is. And I have to thank Governor Hochul, because she has been a true partner in this work. We have passed more bills on expanding doula care in the last, you know, year and a half than I ever thought imaginable. And part of that is increasing access. So now, and I just want to again, give context, when you're talking about Medicaid births, and part of the reason why we focused there first, that's about almost 50% of the births in New York State fall under Medicaid. This year, that'll be about 100,000 births. You're talking about 100,000 people in New York State now can get doula care covered by Medicaid. And the beauty of doing Medicaid first like that legislatively is that I've already had conversations with several private insurance companies who see the need for this and also want to follow suit. And so that, when you talk about culture shift versus legislation, I think that's a perfect example of, we made a legislative change with the Medicaid, but we're actually shifting culture, and now private companies actually want to offer this as well.
You've talked to insurance companies that want to expand coverage?
I have.
Who are these fictional people who don't exist?
Well, let me tell you, I know the business case, right? What's the business case? If I tell you I can reduce the length of birth by 25%, if I tell you I can reduce the rate of emergency C-sections, which, by the way, are very expensive for insurance companies and hospitals, right? And so obviously it's from the care perspective, but if you're running a business, it's care and it's bottom line. And I think a lot of insurance companies understand that it is smart business for them as well. And so we want, and there actually is one in the Capital Region that testified at our hearing on doula care and Medicaid reimbursement. Back in 2023, they actually came and testified, and they're already doing it. And so we're hoping more people follow suit. Very quickly, though, I want to mention, you said, what does that have to do with mental health? And I'll tell you this story, and this is exactly, pinpoints exactly why it's related. With my doula, who I love as well, I remember the moment very clearly. I had finally been able to like walk down the stairs for the first time, like 2 days into this parenthood thing. You know, you're a mess 2 days after 2 days postpartum. And she just looked at me and she said, how are you doing? And literally that question had not been asked of me. I had been so focused on my baby, making sure she was eating, you know, all of these new things. And it forced me to take a second and say, how am I doing? Right? A little mental check-in, and identify if I thought, you know, things weren't going well or if I needed help. And she just gave me that moment to check in on myself. And it's those little moments that having that support from a doula can be so, so helpful. And so when we think about maternal mental health, maternal health, you know, these things work together, right? We don't divide, we can't silo out our lives or our bodies. You know, our physical health is our mental health. And so I look forward to passing, you know, more legislation on expanding doula care. We got a $250,000 grant this year to expand training programs, and I hope to continue that work.
Your critics are going to say New York State covers way too much under Medicaid, and this is just another example of New York State overly expanding Medicaid beyond the basics. What would you say?
They might. What I would say is, can you think of a better investment than health, right? If you own a business, do you want to make sure that the person taking parental leave makes it back, is mentally sound, is physically sound, and actually wants to come back to work, right? If you just live in these communities, right, do you want people who have the supports they need at home? Most of us do, right? We want thriving communities. We want our neighbors to be doing well. And that's how we, you know, start our businesses. That's how we go on to do great things. And so a healthier community, I would dare to say, improves all of our lives.
Do you know how many people, it's very early days, because you said the new doula coverage under Medicaid started January 1 this year.
January 1.
So we're 6-7 months in. We don't know how many people have used it.
We don't know how many people have used it, but the metric we're looking at right now actually is getting doulas enrolled to be Medicaid providers. And so I'm happy to say, you know, I'm not happy to say that it was a low number. Part of the $250,000 grant that we did is trying to increase that number. When we passed our grant program legislation, I mentioned there were 68 doulas, only 68 signed up for Medicaid so far. Good news is it's up to 90 now. So we are moving in the right direction, but that's exactly what that grant expansion is supposed to go to. It's, we're trying to build capacity in these nonprofit, mostly nonprofit organizations who are helping. Sometimes it's one doula that runs their own business. It's only them. They're at a birth. They can't fill out mountains of paperwork. So we have these nonprofits that have been helping train the doulas and also help them fill out all of this administrative paperwork.
All right, back to your phone calls. This is Carly. Next up. Hey, Carly, go ahead.
Hey, two things. First, I'm a mom. I have two kids. I had a baby about a little bit over a year ago. And one thing that was available to me just because of where I was at in life is a postpartum doula. And I had postpartum depression with my first child 8 years ago, and I really wanted to make sure that that wasn't a risk this time and that I could do everything I could to get through it and over it. And I found postpartum doula care to be an essential element of that. And I just wanted to ask, Senator, if you're aware of that. And it seems like there's a lot of statistics coming out about postpartum doula care being a really essential piece of that puzzle.
Okay. And so hang there for 1 second, Carly. We'll come back to you. Senator? Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Carly. So the good news is, specifically for the Medicaid reimbursement, part of that doula, part of the services that are covered does include postpartum appointments. So absolutely right there with you and couldn't agree more. And Carly just pointed out exactly what I was talking about, right? That moment that the doulas give you to reflect and to get you connected to support that you might need. So I'm absolutely in agreement.
And Carly, do you want to add anything there? Go ahead.
Yeah, so my second question was around, like, is it a living wage for doulas, the amount that they can be reimbursed up to through Medicaid? Because I've heard that it's not, and that's part of some of the resistance for signing up.
That's an interesting question.
It's a very fair question. So, you know, I will say I was fighting for more. You know, I worked very closely with our statewide doula community. You know, we came up with, you know, $1,930 as really what we believed an equitable wage. And by the way, I think sometimes it's hard for people to, you know, envision what that doula work looks like. But on average, they're spending 6 to 11 times more time with the pregnant person and their partner than their provider. So, I mean, they're answering your texts at all hours. They're showing up at your house. Mine was there for the birth the entire time, right? So, so you know, $1,930 we thought was an equitable, fair amount. We were not able to get that with this Medicaid reimbursement. The most anyone can get, I believe, is $1,500, but that's only in New York City. It's a little less upstate. So, Carly, if this is you saying you want to help me advocate for more, let's go.
What do you think, Carly?
1,000%. Yeah, I would love okay. to. That's a huge part of what I'd like to be doing going forward. And just thank you so much for all the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you for the phone call, Carly. Carly is an occasional emailer whose emails are really, really smart. And it's nice to get a phone call from Carly. Thank you for that. Stephen writes in to say, Evan, a great show today. Great to meet the senator at the Pride picnic last weekend. I just want to thank her for being such an ally to the LGBTQ plus community and fighting for a better life for everyone. That's Steve in Webster.
Thanks, Steve.
How was the picnic, by the way?
It was a great picnic.
Yeah.
Oh, every year I love that picnic. It really does feel like a family reunion. So highly recommend.
All right, Bonnie in Rochester. Hey, Bonnie, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I know we don't have a lot of time, but one of the things that just has been happening that I think is a clear issue for what we're talking about now, and that is the president himself, Biden. I have never been more blown away in my life than listening to here's a person who was a situation where he, you know, misspoke a little bit, and which happens to people, you know. And then after that, I'm sure there was more than 2 seconds in the media and then a whole bunch of others. He went from that to, oh, my gosh, he probably isn't going to be able to do anything anymore. He's this, he's that, or he's, you know, incapable of knowing what he's doing. So, and it went on and on and on and on. Now, that raises to me an issue, and I was surprised because I thought, well, people must know more about the aging in general than to say something like this. But then that raises the issue to me is how much education are people getting? around, you know, obviously not just this issue, a whole lot of other ones that are misheld too. But this was just, I couldn't believe it. I thought, how could you have such things for with such a limited situation? And again, I just want to indicate, and it was a lot of media people. So, and it spread to others, of course. But I think in the training and education that people get, whether it's at college, whether it's high school, whether it's, you know, whatever, needs to be looked at, because I keep repeating this. I was unbelievably surprised the degree to which this thing got out of control.
Well, let me just jump in here and let the senator respond if you want to. Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate your question. You know, a lot of what you're talking about, it resonates with me, right? You're talking about the understanding, right, of an aging population. And one of the things that actually not many folks know this, but one of the last things I did before running for office was actually working in senior services. And as I say, that was one of the moments that was the straw that broke the camel's back, because I had run into so many challenges trying to serve these folks that I thought, you know, whoever created these policies must not have planned on aging, because they're nearly impossible. It was nearly impossible to find the services I needed. And I thought maybe I could get in there and, you know, make better policy. But I think, you know, I completely empathize with that. I think there is a lack of understanding of what aging looks like, and having a full picture versus having, you know, a flash moment, and not having a full understanding. And that I can totally understand. Obviously, I don't think any of us probably here fully understood or knew, right? We're not with President Biden every day. We see, you know, what we're allowed to have on, you know, on TV. But I appreciate what you're saying.
We didn't even get to talk about the Sonia Massie case. And I want listeners, if you don't know the story, look it up. And that's frankly, it relates to a lot of other issues that we will cover on this program in the days and weeks to come. And perhaps Senator Brooke will add her voice to that conversation. But we did cover a lot of ground this hour, Senator. And I want to thank you for making the time to be here.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
Senator Summer Brooke from the 55th State Senate District. More connections coming up in just a moment.